Chapter 23. Herself down by touching the natural wall of stone on her right hand, as her companion did. Thus, with quick suspense of breathings they arrived at the bottom, and trod the few yards of shingle which, on the forbidding shore hereabout, could be found at this spot alone. It was so solitary, as to be unvisited often for 24 hours by a living soul. Upon the confined beach, were drawn up 2 or 3 fishing lairets, and a couple of smaller ones, beside them being a rough slipway for launching, and a boathouse of tarred boards. The two lovers united their strength, to push the smallest of the boats down the slope, and floating it they scrambled in. The girl broke the silence by asking, "Where are yours?" ... He felt about the boat, but could find none. "I forgot to look for yours." ... He said. "They are locked in the boathouse, I suppose. Now we can only steer, and trust to the current." ... The currents here were of a complicated kind. It was true, as the girl had said, that the tide ran round to the north, but at a special moment in every flood there set in along the shore a narrow reflux contrary to the general outer flow, called the southern by the local sailors. It was produced by the peculiar curves of coast lying east and west of the Beal. These bent southward in 2 back streams, the up channel flow on each side of the peninsula, which 2 streams united outside the Beal, and there met the direct tidal flow, the confluence of the 3 currents making the surface of the sea at this point to boil like a pot, even in calmest weather. The disturbed area, as is well known, is called the Race. Thus, although the outer sea was now running northward to the roadstead, and the mainland of Wessex the southern ran in full force towards the Beal and the Race beyond. It caught the lover's hapless boat in a few moments, and, unable to row across at mere river's width, that it was they beheld the grey rocks near them, and the grim wrinkled forehead of the isle above, sliding away northwards. They gazed helplessly at each other, though, in the long-living faith of youth, without distinct fear. The undulations increased in magnitude, and swung them higher and lower. The boat rocked, received a smart slap of the waves now and then, and wheeled round, so that the lightship which stolidly winked at them from the quicksand, the single object which told them of their bearings, was sometimes on their right hand and sometimes on their left. Nevertheless, they could always discern from it that their course, whether stemwards or sternwards, was steadily south. A bright idea occurred to the young man. He pulled out his handkerchief, and, striking a light, set it on fire. She gave him hers, and he made that flare up also. The only available fuel left was the small umbrella the girl had brought. This was also kindled in an open state, and he held it up by the stem till it was consumed. The lightship had loomed quite large by this time, and a few minutes, after they had burnt the handkerchiefs and umbrella, a colored flame replied to them from the vessel. They flung their arms round each other. "I knew we shouldn't be drowned." ... said a vice hysterically. "I thought we shouldn't too," said he. With the appearance of day a boat put off to their assistance, and they were towed towards the heavy red hulk with the large white letters on its side. 3.7. An old tabernacle in a new aspect, the October day thickened into dusk, and Jocelyn sat musing beside the corpse of Mrs. Pearson. A vice having gone away nobody knew whither, he had acted as the nearest friend of the family, and attended as well as he could to the somber duties necessitated by her mother's decease. It was doubtful, indeed, if anybody else were in a position to do so. Of a vice the second's 2 brothers, one had been drowned at sea, and the other had emigrated, while her only child besides the present of vice had died in infancy. As for her friends, as he had become so absorbed in her ambitious and nearly accomplished design of marrying her daughter to Jocelyn, that as he had gradually completed that estrangement between herself and the other islanders which had been begun so long ago as when, a young woman, as he had herself been asked by Pearson to marry him. On her tantalizing inability to accept the honor offered, she and her husband had been set up in a matter-of-fact business in the stone trade by her patron, but that unforgettable request in the London studio had made her feel ever since a refined kinship with sculpture, and a proportionate aloofness from mere quarrying, which was, perhaps, no more than a venial weakness in the Vice the Second. Her daughter's objection to Jocelyn she could never understand. To her own eye he was no older than when he had proposed to her. As he sat darkling here the ghostly outlines of former shapes taken by his love came round their sister the unconscious corpse, confronting him from the wall in sad array, like the pictured Trojan women beheld by Aeneas on the walls of Carthage. Many of them, he had idealized in bust and in figure from time to time, but it was not as such that he remembered and reanimated them now. Rather was it in all their natural circumstances, weaknesses, and stains. And then as he came to himself their voices grew fainter, they had all gone off on their different careers, and he was left here alone. The probable ridicule that would result to him from the events of the day he did not mind in itself at all. But he would fain have removed the misapprehensions on which it would be based. That, however, was impossible. Nobody would ever know the truth about him, what it was he had sought that had so eluded, tantalized, and escaped him, what it was that had led him such a dance, and had at last, as he believed just now in the freshness of his loss, been discovered in the girl who had left him. It was not the flesh. He had never knelt low to that. Not a woman in the world had been wrecked by him, though he had been impassioned by so many. Nobody would guess the further sentiment, the cordial loving kindness which had lain behind what had seemed to him the enraptured fulfillment of a pleasing destiny postponed for 40 years. His attraction to the third of vice would be regarded by the world as the selfish designs of an elderly man on a maid. His life seemed no longer a professional man's experience, but a ghost story, and he would fain have vanished from his haunts on this critical afternoon, as the rest had done. He desired to sleep away his tendencies, to make something happen which would put an end to his bondage to beauty in the ideal. So he sat until it was quite dark, and a light was brought. There was a chilly wind blowing outside, and the lightship on the quicksand afar looked harassed and forlorn. The haggard solitude was broken by a ring at the door. Pearson heard a voice below, the accents of a woman. They had a ground quality of familiarity, a superficial articulation of strangeness. Only one person in all his experience had ever possessed precisely those tones, rich, as if they had once been powerful. Explanation seemed to be asked for and given, and in a minute he was informed that a lady was downstairs whom perhaps he would like to see. "Who is the lady?" Jocelyn asked. The servant hesitated a little. "Mrs. Lever, the mother of the young gentleman Miss Vice has run off with." "Yes, I'll see her," said Pearson. He covered the face of the dead of Vice, and descended. "Lever," he said to himself. His ears had known that name before today. It was the name those traveling Americans he had met in Rome gave the woman he supposed might be Marcia Bencombe. A sudden adjusting light burst upon many familiar things at that moment. He found the visitor in the drawing room, standing up veiled, the carriage which had brought her being in waiting at the door. By the dim light he could see nothing of her features in such circumstances. "Mr. Pearson?" "I am Mr. Pearson." "You represent the late Mrs. Pearson?" "I do, though I am not one of the family." "I know it." "I am Marcia after 40 years. "I was divining as much, Marcia. May the lines have fallen to you in pleasant places since we last met. But, of all moments of my life, why do you choose to hunt me up now?" "Why, I am the stepmother and only relation of the young man your bride eloped with this morning. I was just guessing that too, as I came downstairs. But and I am naturally making inquiries. Yes. Let us take it quietly, and shut the door. Marcia sat down. And he learned that the conjunction of old things and new was no accident. What Mrs. Pearson had discussed with her nurse and neighbor as vague intelligence was now revealed to Jocelyn at first hand by Marcia herself. How, many years after their separation, and when she was left poor by the death of her impoverished father, she had become the wife of that bygone Jersey lover of hers, who wanted a tender nurse and mother for the infant left him by his first wife recently deceased. How he had died a few years later, leaving her with a boy, whom he had brought up at St. Helers and in Paris, educating him as well as she could with her limited means, till he became the French master at a school in Sandburn. And how, a year ago, she and her son had got to know Mrs. Pearson and her daughter on their visit to the island, to ascertain, she added, more deliberately, not entirely for sentimental reasons, what had become of the man with whom I eloped in the first flush of my young womanhood, and only missed marrying by my own will. Pearson bowed. Well, that was how the acquaintance between the children began, and their passionate attachment to each other. She detailed how a vice had induced her mother to let her take lessons in French of young Lever, rendering their meetings easy. Marcia had never thought of hindering their intimacy, for in her recent years of affliction she had acquired a new interest in the name she had refused to take in her purse-proud young womanhood. And it was not until she knew how determined Mrs. Pearson was to make her daughter Jocelyn's wife, that she had objected to her son's acquaintance with a vice. But it was too late to hinder what had been begun. He had lately been ill, and she had been frightened by his not returning home the night before. The note she had received from him that day had only informed her that a vice and himself had gone to be married immediately, whither she did not know. What do you mean to do? She asked. I do nothing. There is nothing to be done. It is how I served her grandmother one of time's revenges. Served her so for me. Yes. Now she me for your son. Marcia paused a long, while thinking that over, till arousing herself she resumed. But can't we inquire which way they went out of the island, or gather some particulars about them? Yes. We will. And Pearson found himself as in a dream walking beside Marcia along the road in their common quest. He discovered that almost every one of the neighboring inhabitants knew more about the lovers than he did himself. At the corner some men were engaged in conversation on the occurrence. It was elusive only, but knowing the dialect, Pearson and Marcia gathered its import easily. As soon as it had got light, that morning one of the boats was discovered missing from the creek below, and when the flight of the lovers was made known it was inferred that they were the culprits. Unconsciously Pearson turned in the direction of the creek, without regarding whether Marcia followed him, and though it was darker than when the vice and Lever had descended in the morning he pursued his way down the incline till he reached the waterside. Is that you, Jocelyn? The inquiry came from Marcia. She was behind him, about halfway down. Yes, he said, noticing that it was the first time he had called him by his Christian name. I can't see where you are, and I am afraid to follow. Afraid to follow. How strangely that altered his conception of her. Till this moment he had stood in his mind as the imperious, invincible Marcia of old. There was a strange pathos in this revelation. He went back and felt for her hand. I'll lead you down, he said. And he did so. They looked out upon the sea, and the lightship shining, as if it had quite forgotten all about the fugitives. I am so uneasy, said Marcia. Do you think they got safely to land? apostrophe, yes, apostrophe, replied someone other than Jocelyn. It was a boatman smoking in the shadow of the boathouse. He informed her that they were picked up by the lightship men, and afterwards, at their request, taken across to the opposite shore, where they landed, proceeding thence on foot to the nearest railway station, and entering the train for London. This intelligence had reached the island about an hour before. They'll be married tomorrow morning. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Marcia. So much the better. Don't regret it, Marcia. He shall not lose by it. I have no relation in the world except some 20th cousins in the isle, of whom her father was one, and I'll take steps at once to make her a good match for him. As for me, God, I have lived a day too long. Apostrophe, apostrophe, 3, 8. Alas for this gray shadow, once a man. Apostrophe, in the month of November which followed, Pearson was lying dangerously ill of a fever at his house in London. The funeral of the second device had happened to be on one of those drenching afternoons of the autumn, when the raw rain flies level as the missiles of the ancient inhabitants across the beaked promontory which has formed the scene of this narrative, scarcely alighting except against the upright sides of things sturdy enough to stand erect. One person only followed the corpse into the church as chief mourner, Jocelyn Pearson, fickle lover in the brief, faithful friend in the long run. No means had been found of communicating with the vice before the interment, though the death had been advertised in the local and other papers in the hope that it might catch her eye. So, when the pathetic procession came out of the church and moved round into the graveyard, a hired vehicle from Budmouth was seen coming at great speed along the open road from Topow Hill. It stopped at the churchyard gate, and a young man and woman alighted and entered, the vehicle waiting. They glided along the path, and reached Pearson's side just as the body was deposited by the grave. He did not turn his head. He knew it was a vice, with Henry Lever by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.